Tuesday, November 26th. Welcome into Studio 2. I'm Cherry Gregg.
I'm Avi Wolfman-Arendt, and we are truly in Studio 2.
A brand new Studio 2!
Revamped. We left for a week. Someone swapped out all the furniture. I expect Ty Pennington to come out any second with a bullhorn and tell us, you know, what our renovation looks like. It really is lovely, by
the way. It is very lovely. And for folks at home, we have a nice wooden table, brand new mics, brand new lighting. It's gorgeous in here.
Yeah, I love the rug.
Yeah.
Great rug.
I was questionable about the rug, but now that everything's in here, it is good. I love the rug, yes.
Perhaps the rug was acquired at a mall. I'm not sure. Probably
maybe.
Not.
Maybe.
Probably
or
not.
Or maybe not. Yeah.
I would say 20 years ago, it probably would have been purchased at a mall.
True. Yeah, things have changed.
And the mall is the topic of today's show. The mall, the idea of the mall, the concept of the mall, the Great American Mall. Is it fading? Well, not quite. It's evolving. But as this shopping season gets underway, we wanted to take a moment to take stock of American malls and malls in our region.
Mm-hmm.
Where have they been? Where are they going? We got two great guests this hour, including WHYY suburban reporter Kenny Cooper, who will be our first in-person guest in the new Studio 2. We're very excited about that. And we have a couple great questions for you today. And I really, really want to emphasize listener participation today.
We want your calls, yes.
What should malls do to stay relevant? We want to know that. And we also want to know if you have any fond mall memories.
Mm-hmm.
Give us those mall memories, folks. I know you got them. I used to shop at City Place in Silver Spring, Maryland.
Oh, yeah.
What was your mall?
My mall, I worked at Iverson Mall.
Iverson
in
Mall.
Prince George's County, Maryland.
Owned by Allen Iverson.
I don't think so, but
okay.
I used to work at Baker's Shoes, and yeah, that was my first W2 job.
Baker's Shoes?
Yeah.
Was it, did they,
it was
they,
a women's
was it baked
shoe
goods
store.
Or shoes?
Oh, women's shoes. Women's shoe store.
Nice.
Yeah. I used to have all the fly boots, man.
Yeah.
Because
nice.
I worked there. Yeah.
Baker's Shoes. Baker's at the Iverson Mall.
Yes. I caught the P12 to work every day.
Can I go back and ask them about you? Do they remember?
I think Baker's closed.
Oh,
you know, which has happened to a lot of.
Well, look, if you worked at Baker's Shoes back in the day, give us a call, 888-477-9499 or email studio2@whyy.org. Would love to get those mall memories today.
I can't.
And we have a few coming in.
To hear from our listeners, because I know a lot of people, the mall was a big thing in their teenagehood, right?
Sure.
So
freedom.
Yeah. Looking forward to
shopping.
Those stories.
888. Getting your ears pierced.
Oh, yeah. That
Claire's,
too.
Yeah.
Oh, my goodness. You're bringing it all up.
I have a sister.
Oh, yeah. You know. 888-477-9499. Email studio2@whyy.org.
Uh-huh.
And we do have our trio of news stories. So we got to get serious a bit. Immigration and Customs Enforcement, a.k.a. ICE, well, they are looking at options for expanding capacity to detain people. And they're looking at a couple of sites in New Jersey. Immigration and the crisis at the southern border, you know, Avi, was a top issue in the 2024 election. And one of the reasons so many voters leaned right. And so Trump has promised mass deportations, which will require more infrastructure. But this effort to identify this space for new detention centers, all of this was started by the Biden administration. According to the Philadelphia Inquirer, the ACLU acquired documents showing that the administration is considering a facility in Trenton and one in Elizabeth near Newark Airport. The Trenton facility has about 1,000 beds and held state inmates until 2022. The one in Elizabeth has about 300 beds and held immigrants seeking asylum. Now, some advocates in New Jersey, they are sounding the alarm. They are afraid that New Jersey could become ground zero for the mass deportations that could come under the second Trump administration. And they're calling for Biden to stop this process.
Yeah, so don't have a whole lot to add on this, but it's you know, potentially a sign of the times, and we'll see. But as you mentioned, this has all happened under the Biden administration.
Mm-hmm.
This is not directly responsive
Mm-mm.
to anything Donald Trump has said he's going to do. But it's worth keeping an eye on.
And I will say this took me back to the first Trump administration. I covered a potential detention facility for unaccompanied youth.
Yeah.
And they had set it up in North Philly. Can you believe it? Hired a staff of about 65 people, but advocates in Philadelphia, which is a sanctuary city, shut it down. They filed lawsuit. They got it shut down. Everybody was laid off. But, you know, if you remember, in 2019, 2020, yeah. there were unaccompanied minors. They needed a place to go. We took a tour of the facility, but no one wanted to house the actual facility. So it is a sign of the times. And, you know, when you talk about dealing with issues at the border, there's going to have to be places where people are housed, and they might be in communities that are near to you. Mm. So
the one in Philly was never built.
It was built. It was set up.
But it was
people
never
were
used.
Hired, but it was never used. Mm. They shut it down before it opened.
Yeah. Second story here that caught our eye. We know Philly's been slammed hard by the opioid epidemic, mm-hmm. especially the rise in fentanyl. But there was an interesting piece in The New Yorker that you can check out right now on their website that asks whether the opioid epidemic helps explain America's rightward shift over the last 4 years or so. And, you know, you might be thinking, well, how could you disentangle the effect of opioids when looking at voter behavior? But The New Yorker explores this really interesting study. So what this study does is it looks at communities where back in the 1990s, Purdue Pharma really heavily marketed OxyContin when OxyContin was just getting going. That's sort of the gateway to this entire epidemic. And when Purdue Pharma was getting OxyContin going, they really focused on communities with high rates of cancer because they felt if we market it in these communities and we market it as sort of a palliative relief medication for people with cancer, we can then proliferate it more widely. I mean, it's even gross to say that out loud, but that's that was the strategy, right? And so researchers looked at these areas with high cancer rates, and they looked at all sorts of sort of outcomes in those communities, and they compared them to communities that were very, very similar, but just did not have a lot of cancer and therefore were not targeted by Purdue Pharma in the early marketing of OxyContin. And they found a lot of stuff. They found that opioid use was way more widespread in those communities. They found all sorts of ill effects. They also found that those communities shifted much further right in 2020 than comparable communities that simply did not have lots of people with cancer in the 1990s. It's a really interesting study, and it suggests that perhaps the communities that have suffered the most from the opioid crisis are the ones that have moved right the most. Why that is, hard to say. This is not the type of study that's going to give you an answer to that. But it Philadelphia is mentioned in this New Yorker article in part because many neighborhoods here do match that description. And there are places where the opioid crisis really took root.
Yeah, I remember our interview with Mike Coyle, who
from Kensington,
who spoke at the Republican National Convention. He was tired of liberal policies, he said. He wanted to see change. I think about even the shift in Philadelphia politics. Avi, Mayor Sherrill Parker, she's a centrist on this issue, and she made cleaning up Kensington her number one priority. And people have even lost a lot of patients with harm reduction techniques, and they really want to see change. And so a lot of people from those exit polls we saw who voted Republican wanted change.
Yeah.
So, and those communities definitely want change. So,
for sure.
Yeah.
Let's change the topic now. How about that?
Yes. Well, this is a squishy topic a little bit because I like
squishy
because I like squishy movies around
the holidays.
You mean
squishy in a good way.
In a good way.
Yeah.
Totally squishy good. A new Hallmark movie called Christmas on Call is set in Philadelphia. It premiered Friday, November 22nd, and it features Donna Kelsey, mom of NFL superstar brothers Jason and Travis Kelsey. That's news.
That's new. I've moved
you know
news
what I mean?
To me. Yeah.
That's news.
Tell me about this movie.
So this
it's called Christmas
it's called
on Call.
Christmas on Call.
Set in Philadelphia.
Set in Philly.
Not filmed in Philadelphia.
No, it's filmed in Canada. Go figure. Womp womp. But let me tell you about it. So in the lead up to Christmas, here's the storyline. An emergency room doctor juggles her demanding job and a budding romance with an EMT in Philadelphia. They spend time together as the EMT helps her become more acquainted with the sights, sounds, and tastes of Philadelphia.
Slash
and drama
Canada.
Roll, they fall for each other.
Oh, do they really?
They do.
I did not see that
coming.
Yeah,
it's a snap, crackle, pop situation of chemistry.
I would
Hallmark
like to see
movie
this movie.
Style.
I would legitimately, I'm not being facetious, I would like to
really?
See this movie.
Okay.
I have become a convert to Hallmark holiday movies.
What?
My wife introduced me.
Oh, my goodness.
If you want to shut off your brain, there is nothing in the world better than a Hallmark holiday movie. And look, one set in Philadelphia, kind of, I would totally go for that. Absolutely.
Yeah. And by the way, Stephanie Farr reviewed the holiday film. She called it a pandering sap fest, but said she loved it.
It also features this song we're hearing right now called Santa Drives an Astro Van by Mount Joy featuring Jason Kelsey.
I love it.
We will go out with that song and, of course, tell you to keep those mall stories coming because we're talking all about malls, the past, the present,
the future.
Coming up on Studio 2, studio2 at whyy.org. Get those emails in.
Again, you know Santa drives an Astro Van.
No matter what happens in Washington, the NPR Politics Podcast is here for you. For the latest news, insights, and analysis from the election and beyond, listen to the NPR Politics Podcast.
Yeah, I got a new shirt today. Or I went to get something like some food, you know, some like the old school Cinnabon or some pretzel.
Me and my friends used to come here and hang out. It was a safe place for all of us to just gather together, go to the movies, eat, shop.
Malls were good times when I was a kid. That was where you went, you know, especially if you had some foul weather. Everybody hung out at the mall until they threw you out. But, you know, I remember I missed the arcade places back in the mall back in the old days.
Welcome back to Studio 2. I'm Cherry Gregg.
And I'm Avi Wolfman Arendt. You just heard the voices there of Andrew, who recently moved from California to Philadelphia. Andrea from Atlanta, who is visiting her friend in Bucks County, and Rich from Philadelphia. We did not hear any former employees of Baker's Shoes at Iverson Mall, but I'm still holding out hope.
They could call in.
They can call in. The American shopping mall is dead. Mm. Well, at least that's what you might believe if you look at vacant malls across the country, see headlines of yet another department store closure, or simply look at the numbers showing an increase in online retail, especially post-pandemic. Yes. Some malls are struggling, and if they don't adapt and find creative ways to stay relevant, some will fizzle out. But do we really have to say goodbye to malls forever?
Well, lots of experts say no, that if we look a bit closer, we'll find that some malls, including ones in our region like King of Prussia and Cherry Hill, well, they are trying something new, hoping for a mall renaissance of sorts. They're anticipating that in order to keep customers coming back, it's time to pivot to fun experiences, entertainment, fine dining, and a whole lot more.
Two great guests with us this hour. Barbara Kahn is a professor of marketing at the Wharton School at the University of Pennsylvania. Barbara Kahn, welcome to Studio 2.
Well, thank you very much. Pleasure to be here.
It's a pleasure to have you. We also have Kenny Cooper, a suburban reporter for WHYY News, who has a series looking at the past and future of malls in our area. Hey, Kenny, welcome back to Studio 2.
Hey, thanks for having me.
And we want to make sure that our listeners at home can chime in. So what should malls do to stay relevant? Or tell us if you shop at the mall, or do you have fond memories to share? Like the one I had about working at Baker's Shoes. Anyway.
Yeah, what shoe store did you work at?
You could call
Foot Locker.
Yes, tell us your story. 888-477-9499. You can also email studio2@whyy.org.
Payless, that was another one.
Oh, yeah, remember
Payless. Remember
Payless.
Yeah. So, Kenny Cooper, we'd love to start with you and talk about some of your reporting. So, I wanted to talk about a couple of malls that you focused on. Granite Run, King of Prussia. Because I feel like in those two examples, you can get a sense of where malls have fallen short, mm-hmm. and where malls are thriving. So let's start. Granite Run. Let's tell us a little bit about Granite Run. It was in Delco, right?
Yeah, Granite Run was in Delco, right outside of Media. And for a while there, it was one of the premier malls to go in Delaware County, mm-hmm. right? You know, especially with that boom in malls and the creation and growth of the mall industry, Granite Run kind of benefited from that growth, from that
70s, 80s, 90s.
Yeah, 70s and 80s, right? So it kind of benefited from that growth and expansion of the industry. So early on in the Granite Run Mall, you know, it was kind of seen as like one of the premier malls to go in Delaware County. So I think that was at a time when people really viewed the mall as the cultural phenomenon, which is why, you know, different counties could support one, two, even three malls.
Yeah. And what happened?
Well, the Granite Run Mall is no more, right? So yeah. What has happened is in 2015, the mall closed. Mm. It underwent a process of demalling years prior to it officially closing.
Demalling.
Yeah,
like
demalling.
Term,
demalling. Yes.
Term,
I didn't make up the term, so I can't take credit for it, right? But it went through that process of demalling. And what that means is that essentially you're kind of stripping the mall for parts, more or less. You're trying to figure out which anchor stores you want to save, which, you know, stores may have to say goodbye. And in its grave now stands the Promenade at Granite Run, which is this mixed-use development that kind of fuses together this idea of, you know, these lifestyle centers, but also keeping some of the retail, physical retail aspects of a mall.
But it's not an enclosed indoor mall.
Exactly.
Anymore.
It's not enclosed.
And so, you know, Avi kind of teased this a little bit, but we want you to compare Granite Run to now King of Prussia.
Yeah, which is a hard task to do because King of Prussia is not one of the, just one of the biggest malls in the region. It's one of the biggest malls in the country. You know, it's kind of on par with Mall of America in terms of being almost a tourist attraction just because of its sheer size, right? Again, another mall that was, you know, popular early on, popular during that boom. But because it's been able to maintain that momentum, right, it's only it's just kept on growing.
Yeah.
And it's kind of allowed itself. I think at one point it was the court and the plaza. Now it's combined.
It's been growing, yeah.
Then it's growing another wing. Like, it's constantly shifting and changing each year.
And is that the big difference between those two malls that you've seen and studying this?
Yeah, I think so, right? I think, one, they serve different audiences. But two, early on, King of Prussia was already just like a really relatively larger mall, yeah. Right? It wasn't necessarily the three-story mall of Willow Grove, but it still contained a lot of space. And I just think that area, you know, just looking at the demographics of the area that surrounded it, it was kind of primed for something like this. You know, I don't think you can just drop a King of Prussia anywhere. You kind of have to look at the townships and boroughs that are surrounding it.
Mm.
You said they serve different audiences, the two malls. What do you mean by that?
So I think if you go to that part of Delaware County, you're talking different income levels.
Yeah.
Not even necessarily different demographics per se, but if you go back in that time, you know, those are slightly different income levels. And it's also just different points of access. You know, King of Prussia Mall is right off of a really busy highway. So it's really easy access for someone. At times, if you have access to a car, and I think we'll get to that point, it's easy access if you have access to a car to get to a place like King of Prussia.
Yeah.
Follow
up, though, on King of Prussia, because you talked about reinvention, and I think this will, you know, lead us into other parts of the conversation. In your reporting, you talked about how KOP is investing in experiential types of, I don't even know how to define it more than that. They're things that you go to do, not places you go to shop. So, like, there's this thing called the Netflix House, which replaced Lord & Taylor, an old department store. I feel like that's a really interesting example that shows us where we're headed.
Yeah, you're absolutely right. You know, a few of these people, experts that I spoke to for this story, Barbara Kahn was one of them. She was great. Another person I spoke to was Alexandra Lang, you know, author of Meet Me by the Fountain. And what she basically said is, if you're a person that enjoys mall watching, this idea of, we all know the term people watching. We're just watching people, mall watching, right? If you enjoy this term of mall watching, if you take a closer look at what these malls are doing and trying to meet the needs of the future, it really breaks down into two major categories. And then there's some other offshoots as well, right? But if you're trying to look at concepts within the existing structure, like architecture-wise, business-wise of the mall, you're looking at more experiences and more food places. King of Prussia is going the experiential route. So you're seeing this Netflix house, which...
what is that?
We still haven't seen it yet, right? So I think...
I was like, I might drive to King of Prussia for this. It's just intriguing
enough. I mean, even just
enough.
The headline itself is punchy. You know, can Stranger Things save the mall, right? Yeah, it's this idea that... Right. You're going to have this this experiential place where people get to see their TV shows and their movies up close and personal. You know, it just kind of piques the ear. It's just like, what is that? You know,
and I'm replacing a Lord and Taylor, which is feels like classic old school mall.
Exactly. Yeah. Right. You know, at a time where a lot of these department stores are struggling, you know, being able to find a new anchor that's new, that gets people's interest, that's experiential. You know, these are the type of swings that malls have to make to see if they can land with audiences.
Yeah, we want to make sure our listeners at home chime in. What should malls do to stay relevant? Tell us if you shop at the mall or if you have fond memories to share. Our number is 888-477-9499. You can also email studio2@whyy.org. I want to bring in a caller to join the conversation. Mark is from New Jersey. Mark, you're on Studio 2. What's your question or comment?
Well, I don't have a question, but I do have a comment. I have become a mall walker because I use Quaker Ridge Mall and Oxford Valley Mall. And I have noticed over the year or so the decline in businesses in there. They start to fall off fast. Then they have signs up that say, we're starting new. And it's quite a while before anything does come to take a place in there.
Yeah.
But I'll say the nice thing I like about walking the mall is, as a facilities manager, I know the technology. They do have a lot of clean air because the air filters are in place.
I like
the air
that.
Fresh and clean. And they've got high-level air filters. And then they also keep the building temperature comfortable.
Yeah.
It's a one.
It's a nice environment to walk around in. That's Mark
New from
Jersey.
New Jersey.
Thank you so much for that comment. A mall walker.
I love that.
I never heard that term
before.
Yeah,
a lot of people, you know, use the mall as a safe place to kind of get exercise and get those steps in, and you can walk around the mall. Right. Yeah. So I want to bring Barbara Kahn, a professor of marketing at the Wharton School at the University of Pennsylvania, into the conversation. Barbara, you've been listening to Kenny tell us about our regional malls. And so I want to go back to the beginning of malls and the phenomenon that they were in their heyday. Could you just take us back to them and tell us how malls developed and why people fell in love?
Well, I mean, I guess the architecture or the development, the planning of malls was to start with what they called were anchors, which typically were these department stores, which would draw people into the mall to visit the anchor store, which would be like Macy's or JCPenney's or Sears, or the higher end could have been Saks or Neiman Marcus. And then once they were there at that anchor store, they would wander around the mall, which would then feature other types of retail, which we fondly remembered as mall retail, like you were mentioning Baker Shoes or Claire's, where you could get your ears pierced. Mm-hmm. People who went back to the old malls would remember all of those little stores that were typically mall stores. And the old malls were definitely more retail oriented. There was food there, but they tended to be in a food court, not necessarily restaurants and things. And the idea in going in the mall would be to shop, to browse, to look at all the available opportunities there for potential buying, but you didn't have to buy, but was definitely very retail focused. And one of the things that Kenny was saying, which I have a slightly different way of identifying what these malls were, but I agree with what he was saying, but the malls used to be categorized, and they still are, as A, B, or C malls. And what that meant was kind of the socioeconomic or the economic level of the malls. And they were typically identified by their anchor stores. So the A malls would be higher priced stores, like, and would be more likely to be anchored by a Saks and a Neiman. And the B and C malls would be more likely to be anchored by a JCPenney or Macy's. And when the mall started to close and go dark, the malls that went dark tended to be the B and C malls because that kind of shopping at that lower level was more, you could do more of that online, and there were other reasons why those malls started to go out. But the malls that stayed and were more successful were these A malls, which were more luxury related, higher, probably higher retail, more the kind of retail where you would want to touch and feel the product
before you spend all the money. Yeah.
I think that's a lot of what was happening at King of Prussia also.
Can we go back and maybe do a little summary, Barbara Kahn, of when we hit, when sort of malls took off, when we sort of hit peak mall and where we are today?
Well, I don't know the actual history years of when the peak malls happened or when not. So I can't tell you actually what point in time, but I can tell you by 2017, we were calling it the year of the retail apocalypse. Mm-hmm. And that was because a lot of these B and C malls were starting to go dark. And the reason they were going dark, as I said, was because these anchor stores, which drove people to the mall, they were starting to close. And once the anchor closed, the rest of the mall kind of followed. And at that time, I think you started to see a bifurcation of malls where the B and C malls were starting to go dark or maybe repurposing, as Kenny said, and the A malls were starting to reinvest in this luxury or experiential, shopping. And this, of course, is bifurcation that you saw in 2017, which was dubbed the retail apocalypse, was really exacerbated by COVID. And so saw a lot of malls, you know, were in trouble during COVID. Well, people weren't shopping in physical retail. But when people started going back into the stores, the ones that were surviving were more of these A malls.
Yeah.
I'm not sure if that answered your question, but that's kind of what was happening at the time.
Yeah, thank you for that, Barbara. I want to read a couple emails we got. Tracy says, memories of the mall go back to my teens, a time of hanging out at the mall, meeting up with friends and beginning independence into adulthood. Today, many teens are banned from the malls unless accompanied by adults. I think this is part of the decline. It's a shame that our young people have fewer opportunities for that emerging independence. And so this got me thinking, both Barbara and Kenny, like sort of the cultural phenomenon that the mall represents. You know, I grew up, you know, that was the place where you went with your friends. Your parents could drop you off and you could be unattended, right? At like 14, nobody bothering you. You hanging out with your friends, go to the movies. You could have $10 and enjoy a day at the mall. And so can you talk about the cultural shift, if any, that this sort of like the mall, the BC mall decline sort of has caused? And Kenny, I'll start with you because you even have some local stories.
Yeah, it kind of starts... To answer that question, you kind of got to go back through the history of the mall. You know, its creation in like 1950s, right? It was created by a Jewish architect who was fleeing Nazi Germany or Nazi Austria, the Austrian incursion or Nazi incursion into Austria, rather. And he kind of brought this idea of this Viennese style architecture to America. This idea that, you know, you're looking off into these suburbs and you don't see a lot of places where people connect. And he goes to Minnesota.
Not a lot of civic squares.
Yeah, there's not a lot of town centers, civic squares where people can kind of exchange ideas, hang out, especially in places that are cold. That's why I thought it was so compelling to kind of hear the caller earlier talk about mall walking. You know, these malls promise 365 days of climate control shopping early on, right? But it's not just shopping, you know? I think it's kind of it's sitting by the fountain. You know, it's all this kinds of stuff.
The atmosphere, hanging
out with friends, right? Yeah. Mm-hmm. And you know, that kind of went off into peak mall in the 80s and 90s. That's when you kind of see peak mall. That's when you see kids become mall rats, right? I caught the back end of that. I'm in my mid 20s, so I caught the back end of kind of this mall explosion, right? But even I can remember as a teenager some of my friends hanging out at the mall, right? But as you mentioned, there has been this shift, right? I mean, I think people may have fundamentally understood that at the end of the day, the mall is trying to make money, right? And I think for the longest, it did kind of serve as this quasi-public space. But with these malls struggling, I mean, a lot of them have taken this really abrupt shift to being like, you know, we are here to make money. So if this means that we're going to try and experiment and, you know, kick kids out of the mall, that's what we're going to do. And it really, you know, it really upset a lot of people, right? These decisions to ban, you know, unaccompanied teenagers from the mall. Willow Grove Mall is a recent example, right, where you have to have a chaperone.
Under 18.
Yeah, exactly, right?
So district here in Philadelphia
Exactly. And it's part of what these malls are doing. They think that it's going to increase the experience, the shopping experience for shoppers. But I think they have to also ask themselves, you know, what would the mall be without teenagers? The same people that made the mall popular are now the ones that are being banned from malls. So it's a really like interesting shift that some malls are taking to kind of figure out and navigate, hey, who do we truly want to serve? Do we want to serve this ideal shopper that's in their 30s and 40s and 50s or the kids that kind of made the mall popular to begin with?
Yeah, some interesting comments coming in. Here's one from Alexis. For my entire 45-year life, the Exton Mall has always been the closest mall to where I live. Over the past decade, Exton Mall has slowly become a ghost town. It has about 5 open stores now, and the bottom level is just medical space and an arcade. It's so sad to see it in its current state. My husband and I love retail therapy, but I just realized I've been part of what is killing malls. I just started using Amazon for the first time a few months ago and have completed all of my holiday shopping on Amazon. So that's Alexis's comment. That idea, Alexis mentioned that there were these non-retail stores using space inside malls. And as malls evolve, I get the sense that we are seeing more malls you know, lease out their space to all sorts of different types of businesses and schools. I mean, Barbara Kahn, do you have any insights there into how malls are being repurposed in an effort to stay afloat?
Yeah, and Kenny mentioned this also, this idea of this multi-use of the retail space. And so you're seeing other kinds of things besides just the retail stores selling things, or even restaurants. You're starting to see gyms take place in there. You're seeing like experiential things like bars that feature golf or other bowling or other kinds of activities taking the space. So it's not selling actual items, it's selling more things that people want to do, because you can buy the actual items, as your listener just said, on Amazon. And so once you get that item, what's the point of going to the store? It's easier to buy it on Amazon. You want to go to the store for something that you either need to touch and feel or something you do. And so the space is being picked up by these more experiential uses. You see even like nail salons and hair places and skin facials and even like little dock in the box, little medical centers.
Yeah. So interesting. I want to read this comment from John in Philadelphia, who says, I go to Plymouth Meeting Mall. It's a great two-story mall. If they would sell me a store on the second level as an apartment, I would live there.
Okay.
Yes. And Dave writes, the Morristown Mall in New Jersey has been taken over by Cooper Hospital and apartments. I think I can get behind that. Parking lots are repurchased. I want to talk about that, because housing has been an option for some of these malls, Kenny. People are talking about a couple of local malls that they're, can you comment on that?
Yeah, I mean, it's definitely, you know, again, going back to something that I learned from one of the experts that I spoke to for the story, Alexandra Lang, she said that, you know, the malls initially were supposed to be an answer to a problem. So if you're going to try and continue out that mission, you have to look and see what problems exist today that these malls and this extra space could solve. And housing is definitely a big one, especially in the Philadelphia suburbs, where, you know, to find good quality housing is you know, it's hard to find because it's so expensive. We have a housing affordability issue. So I think on the one hand, some of these malls stepping into the business of being landlords, more or less, or constructing apartments will help ease some of that problem. But when you look at the actual pricing of some of these housing some of these are luxury apartments. You know, they're not it's not necessarily going to be relieve the biggest strain on housing as one might think, because, you know, it's only solving part of the problem, which is the housing problem, not the affordability problem.
Right. Give us a call if you've got some mall memories to share. That's what we're talking about this hour on Studio 2, talking about malls. 888-477-9499. Some of our listeners think we're being a little bit too nostalgic.
Mm-hmm.
Matt says, let's not forget that malls killed small town businesses. Look at any mall and then the small town near it, and you will see the struggles the mall created. For example, Lansdale was gutted because everyone went to Montgomery Mall.
Mm.
Holly says, I certainly shopped at malls, but malls were the death knell of the grand downtown department stores found in cities. I've lived in many cities and enjoyed their elegant restaurants. But it makes me sad that most of them have closed. Macy's is not the same as Wanamaker's. Mm. This is all part of a continuum. And Barbara Kahn, I would love to get your thoughts on that. So what did malls replace, and what might replace
the
malls?
That's a good one.
Well, that's an interesting idea. Yeah, and it's funny that they say that about town centers, because you're seeing a reinvigoration of these town centers.
It's,
you know,
full
as
circle.
Malls are closing. Yeah, it's going full circle. I think what's going to emerge, I'm hoping, is going to actually be better. You know, like these town centers that are replacing some of the department stores that used to only be in the mall are now being built downtown. Macy's are building some of their newest stores outside of the mall. And so this idea of a town center, and that's what Kenny was saying too. I think malls were originally designed to do that, and maybe they kind of lost their way and they became not necessary as online shopping happened. But what you want in a new mall, or what you want in a town center, is something that's kind of a mixture. You want some retail, you want some experiential, you want to do things in a physical space that you can't do online. And some of it is shopping for things that you want to try on. You know, you can't buy everything the same way online as you can in a physical store. And so these well-designed town centers are having services as well as some retail, as well as some food. And I think some of the better malls are moving in that direction too, where they have some retail that you can buy, but also a lot more restaurants and things. Yeah. And another thing that's different about malls that changed is in the old days when you would rent space, you needed to take out a very long lease. And so you didn't see these changes in retail because people had these really long leases.
They were locked in.
After COVID in particular, the leases got shorter. And now you even see things like pop-ups. So you see this real change, this transformation, this kind of excitement.
Yeah,
you
could go in. Very dynamic, really.
It's only going to be there for a little while. And it gives you a reason to go shopping. It gives you a reason to go out.
Yeah.
And do something. So it's entertainment in a way. Like someone mentioned early, the idea of retail therapy. But it can really be entertainment when it's a store that's not going to be there for very long.
Yeah, that's a good point. Yeah. Pop-ups. Look out for those pop-ups.
That.
They're popping.
We're going to be talking about the future of malls. Some of these shifts. We're going to explore that a little more. And we want to hear from you. Share your mall stories, right? 888-477-9499. Email studio2@whyy.org. Loving the music right now.
No matter what happens in Washington, the NPR Politics Podcast is here for you. For the latest news, insights, and analysis from the election and beyond, listen to the NPR Politics Podcast.
I mean, I feel like growing up, we would always come, like specifically King of Prussia, but like in general, like back to school shopping, like me and my mom and my brother would always like make a big trip out of it, and it would be very fun.
Born in the 80s, a child of the 90s, and yeah, the malls were our go-to. Obviously, in our area, Springfield Mall was the closest geographically, and we had a trolley that ran right there, so until you get your driver's license, that was, you know, your main go-to.
Bringing more engagements to the mall, like amusement parks inside of the mall, or things that's like, you know, more fun and engaging for kids, that's what I would probably want to see.
And welcome back to Studio 2. I'm Avi Wolfman-Arendt.
And I'm Cherry Gregg. You just heard from Chloe from New Hope, Chris from Delaware County, and Haja from Philadelphia. And if you are just joining us, we're talking about the future of the American shopping mall. And we have two guests with us. We have Barbara Kahn, a professor of marketing at the Wharton School, and Kenny Cooper, a WHYY news reporter who recently published a fascinating two-part feature on this topic.
And our questions for you today. One, what should malls do to stay relevant? And two, do you have some mall memories to share with us? Give us a call, 888-477-9499, or email studio2@whyy.org. Christopher says, I love the mall back in the 80s and 90s at their height. I worked at a music store at the Burlington Mall 10 years ago, and most of the stores were either moving out or going out of business. The facilities were crumbling. There was theft. A sense of foreboding prevailed. Since online shopping, what company would want to pay rent and pay employees? Teenagers don't leave their rooms anymore, so why leave?
Yeah, and this brought up the memory of one of the retailers, actually a pizza shop, that you profile, Kenny, in your pieces. Could you tell us about this pizza shop and just sort of how it's emblematic of the rise and fall of the mall?
So I think if the listeners frequent the Granite Run Mall, or if they did in Delaware County, they may be familiar with Scotto Pizza. Mm-hmm. They kind of ruled the food court early on when the mall was around. And even like for 30 years, Scotto Pizza was kind of the main destination for pizza inside the Granite Run Mall. And the main character that I spoke to for this part of the story, his name is Alessandro Spinato. And he doesn't currently work at the mall. In fact, he works all the way down in Wilmington now at his own pizza shop, Siddeley To Go. And he reached out early on in the process when I was doing my call outs online saying like, hey, share your memories of the mall. You know, what do you want us to talk about in regards to the mall stories? He kind of reached out pretty early on with his own theory. And his theory was kind of grounded in his own experiences. His idea was that the mall didn't just die, it was killed, right? You know, he's coming from the perspective of the son of the owner of that pizza shop, right? He grew up there. He actually told me this story that when he was born at the hospital, he didn't go home first. He actually went to the pizza store first.
They took the baby to the pizzeria.
Because all the family members were working there. So it was just like, if you want people to see the baby, you're not going to take him home. You're going to take him straight to the pizzeria, right? So he kind of has these really like vivid memories of the mall. Like when he was talking to me, he was like, you know, Destiny's Child and Beyonce performed there. I'm like, wait a second.
At the mall?
Sure enough, I found photo evidence of Destiny's Child performing. And he was just talking about how in the early days, like the top levels would shake because there were so many people that just wanted to go to the mall. Yeah. Right. So his story is one that progressively kind of, you know, he starts talking about how things went wrong. And for his father's business, it was the rising rent, right? It was the fact that, you know, these mall owners saw how popular it was. They also saw some of the decreasing foot traffic. And their response to some of that was to raise the rent, right? And for a lot of these small businesses that were in the mall, some of them may be connected to franchises or whatnot. But a lot of them were run by, you know,
families,
right? So, you know, it's only so much that you can take when it comes to these rising rents.
And the last rent that they had at Scotto Pizza was like $16,000 a month.
Yeah.
Mm. Wow.
Well, speaking of pricey, here's a comment from Ruth who says, I grew up with King of Prussia Plaza. Many of its stores were affordable for our family. There was always a lot to see and do. There were public programs on a regular basis, which I got to participate in several times. I miss that. Now it's for the rich folks. That's Ruth's comment. Let's bring in another caller. This is Mike from New Hope. His mall was Quaker Bridge Mall in the 70s. Mike, hit us with some good memories on Studio 2. What's your question or comment?
Yeah, we had some great memories. When school would let out for the summer, we'd take $60, $70, and we'd get concerts for the whole summer. There was a Ticketron there, and you would get Frank Zappa for $6.50.
Wow.
Steve Miller was $7. Led Zeppelin was extremely expensive. They were $17.50.
$0.07. Outrageous. Mike, tell me your favorite concert, that you went to that you bought a ticket at the mall for.
It was Led Zeppelin. It was the last night at the Garden, 1977.
Wow.
Wish I was there. I can almost smell it.
$17.50. That takes you back. Now tickets are like hundreds of dollars.
Yeah. Thanks, Mike. Thanks, Mike.
Oh, yeah.
So
what a nice memory.
But there is some full circle in that, in the idea of experiences being the future of the mall. But also I wanted to get Barbara Kahn, your thoughts on this. The idea that the businesses of the future, the online retailers, do still want physical space. And we've seen that pop up a little bit. And when you see one of these online first retailers open a brick and mortar, whether it's in a mall or a mixed use development, you kind of scratch your head. So what's the explanation for that?
You know, it's interesting several ways. What people were talking about, the old days of the mall, that is what's evolving now. So some of the more of these upscale malls, they're starting to have concerts, they're having museum exhibits. They're trying to recreate some of the warm experiences that people are bringing up with their memories. It's interesting to hear that go full circle, because that was a really good idea. It drew people into the mall, and they're going to try to redevelop that in these new spaces. But to your point about these online retailers that open physical space, there's been a lot of study on that. And actually what happens is when they open up a physical store, because modern retail is what's called omnichannel, which is a seamless integration between online and offline, and the inventory and the data and everything goes back and forth between the two online and offline kind of realms. When these online retailers open up a store like a Bonobos or a Glossier or Untuckit, these were retailers that started online, but they are now opening up some physical stores. That actually increases the sales for both the in-store and online, because if you think about shopping, I don't think from the consumer point of view, they think of it as either or. They think of it, I want sometimes to go online, sometimes to go into a physical store. I think of it as one experience, and I don't want it to be either or. And so I think a lot of retail is developing into what's called this omni-channel kind of experience. And it's a lot of times connected through your physical store. I mean, your physical phone. So when you go into the store, you can be on your phone, you can be checking things out online and then seeing what's there in the store. So I think this whole notion of retail is changing, it's evolving.
Yeah, I like that. I want to read a couple more emails from our listeners. Beatrice emails, I'm getting sentimental about the gallery with more than two options to get music. Sam Goody's is where I bought the best tapes and CDs.
Yeah.
I met great people at Strawbridge and Clothier's Food Court, which was like a dream food paradise. They had Bassett's ice cream and other gourmet goodies. Art emails, as an adult, I always hated malls, especially around Christmas. In the 80s and 90s, I did my shopping on Chestnut and Market Streets. I'm glad stores are moving back to the streets. So, Barbara, my question for you is, when you look at malls that are doing well now and you look at the malls that have been failing, what's the biggest, tell me some of the, you know, some of the key factors you see in the malls that are thriving now and have sort of made the pivot and adaption to the new age.
I think the thriving malls are these A malls where there's a reason to go into the physical space, whether it is these restaurants or experiential things or seeing product. Like I said, you want to touch and feel. You don't just want to buy it online. And the malls that aren't doing well are the ones that are just reproducing what you can do more easily online. And you're also seeing that in town centers and things. Hopefully, this would be wonderful news, especially when that caller talked about the heyday of Market Street and Chestnut Street. Wouldn't it be great if we saw like those streets redeveloped and great retail again? It's there was a heyday back in the days of the Wanamaker department store back on Walnut. You know, like it was wonderful to go into the city center and see those great stores there. So you can imagine something where it's redeveloped and but catering more to what the kind of product people want to buy, the kind of experiences they want to have. You have to keep looking to see what the shoppers are demanding and try to deliver that value to them.
Yeah. It's so interesting you mentioned that because Center City District just happened to come out with a report
this morning
about shopping in Center City, Philadelphia. And one of the things they noted in the report is that a lot of the storefronts are now being dedicated to these experiences. It's like virtual golf and barcade and bowling and all that, you know, mini golf for adults, indoor mini golf. It's an interesting read. I want to bring in another caller now. This is Bree from Mount Laurel, who is going to tell us about Christmas Eve at the mall. Take us there, Bree. You're on Studio 2.
Christmas Eve at the Cherry Hill Mall in the 80s. Packed, and every year, no matter what, we always forgot something and we're running dispensers and there was like a gajillion people, but they were nice. It wasn't like it is now where people are like grabbing things out of people's hands. It was just it was like a Christmas tradition. And one year my mom and I took the train, we took a bus and then this high speed line, and we were walking home and it was starting to snow, and it was just one of my favorite memories.
I love that. Thank you so much, Bree.
Thank you, Bree.
The way, Cherry Hill Mall was one of the malls that you profiled, Kenny. Mm-hmm. And we heard earlier Barbara talking about like restaurants and experiences. And Cherry Hill Mall is one of those places that's evolving. It sounded like by investing in higher end eating options. It's not just about the food court anymore, right?
Right. Yeah. They have something called a restaurant row. They've invested a lot of money in, right? And it goes back to this idea that, you know, I think everyone knows this saying, in order to make money, you have to spend some money. So, you know, that's what it requires. It requires, you know, going back to the drawing board and saying like, hey, what's working? What's not hitting with customers? What is landing with customers? And I think at the end of the day, you know, going back and hearing all these people, what they have to say, the biggest memories that stick out that are the most vivid and, you know, interesting are always the stuff around the experiences that people were having at the mall or the food that they were eating. You know, everyone can kind of describe and understand what it feels like to eat like a really cinnamon covered pretzel at the mall. Like, we can all kind of visualize that, right?
I don't remember what I bought at Burlington Coat Factory in 2001, but I do remember like
those snickerdoodle cookies.
Yeah, exactly.
Or that cinnamon sugar is hard to get off your hands, right? So I think that between all those things, that's what these malls kind of look back at and say, hey, you know, this could work.
Yeah, and maybe we can squeeze one more caller in. We have Susan from Philly. You're on Studio 2. What's your comment?
Take us home, Susan.
Yeah.
Hi, how are you guys? Thank you for doing this. So I grew up in Mount Airy, and we used to go to the Cedarbrook Mall. And Corvettes was the anchor store.
Mm.
And it was a rite of passage to go to the mall. We got $5 and we got dropped off. And it was a big deal. And there was a Woolworths there with a counter to eat lunch. Fancy. I mean, we're talking like, it was simple. It was, but Corvettes was, you know, that was like, that was a dream place back then. You know, we grew up in an area where there was row houses and twins and everybody knew everybody. But when you went to that mall, I mean, your mom got dropped off and you got picked up at the end of the day. And it was such a treat.
Yeah. Thank you so much, Susan. Hanging out at Corvettes.
I love it. And by the way, thank you for the folks who commented about Baker Shoes. Laura comments, my husband worked at Baker Shoes in Allentown when we were in high school. He bought me my first pair of pumps and boots from the store as a Christmas gift. We are now married over 41 years. That's a Baker's love story right there.
You might have done that for someone, Sherry.
I could have done that.
And Sally
says, I grew up in Pittsburgh and love Baker's Shoe Store, too. So there you go.
A lot of love this hour. A lot of love, a lot of shopping. Let me thank our guests. You've been lovely. Kenny Cooper, WHYY News reporter, covering the suburbs. Thanks, Kenny.
Thanks for having me.
And Barbara Kahn, professor of marketing at the Wharton School. Thank you so much for your time.
Yeah, thank you. It's a pleasure.
And thank you to everybody who emailed in, to all our callers. And thank you to our producers, Debbie Builder, Paige Murray-Bessler, and Andreas Copes. Thank you so much to Diana Martinez and Tina Calique, who engineered today's show. Our executive producer is Kevin McCory. From Studio 2, the brand new Studio 2 at WHYY in Philadelphia, I'm Cherry Gregg.
And I'm Avi Wolfman-Arendt. We will talk with you tomorrow.